Hey, I'm Michaela LaFrac, the host of Vermont Edition. The podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Michaela LaFrac. The meaning behind the name of the public radio talk show 1A is twofold. Its original host, Joshua Johnson, says 1A refers both to the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which protects five critical freedoms, including the freedom of the press, and what newspapers often use to describe as the front page stories featured each day above the fold. The current host of 1A, Jen White, not only carries on and honors that commitment to the show's origins and meaning, but has expanded its scope, reach, and impact. Her ability to connect with people in a manner that is at once authoritative, warm, and approachable has made 1A appointment listening for public radio listeners all across the country. Vermont Public recently added both hours of 1A to our daily morning program schedule, and members of the show's team, along with Jen, have been spending this past week with us here broadcasting from this very studio. Jen White also engaged in a live panel discussion for a 1A program about the housing crisis at the Essex Cinemas this week that included our housing and infrastructure reporter, Carly Berlin. And to cap it all off, we are delighted to bring you this special Friday edition of Vermont Edition with Jen White as our guest. Jen White, thank you so much for being so generous with your time all week long and, of course, right now.
Well, Mitch, it's a great pleasure to be here. We've had a wonderful time here in Vermont. It's been incredibly hospitable, and everyone's been so warm, and the state is lovely, lovely.
I'm so glad to hear all of that. Well, Jen, the Vermont Public staff has really enjoyed getting to know you and the 1A team this week. As I've mentioned, there's been a lot of idea swapping, some producer training, you know, stuff like that. We've learned a ton. I'm wondering, though, if you can tell us a bit more about these kinds of collaborative visits and how it helps your team, if at all, to come to a member station and set up shop for a week.
Yeah, you know, because this show is produced out of Washington, D.C., it's easy to get caught up in what's happening in Washington, D.C., and to become disconnected from how laws and policies affect people across the country. Yeah. And so moving outside of D.C. and visiting stations in California and in Texas and Alabama, it brings us to our audience, and it gives us a different perspective. Because if you're just in D.C., you're going to get that perspective. But when we go into communities, we learn about how policies affect them, but also some of the specific challenges they're facing, some of the specific opportunities they think their state or city has or their town. And that's really valuable for us as a show, because we're interested in helping Americans have a conversation with one another. And we can't do that if we're just in Washington, D.C.
I can imagine, too, D.C. being what it is and the center of so much sometimes chaos and things going on, that it can feel even a little more insular that way. Mm-hmm. So the effort to break out of that must be refreshing, I would think. Jen, for someone who's never heard 1A before, how would you describe the program and what it offers each day?
So 1A is a program that is listener-centered and listener-driven. So much of what we do is really based on how you, as a listener, want to engage with the program, either through emails or calls or voicemails, pitches. A lot of the ideas for the show come from our audience. So that's one central tenet. Another part of what we focus on is what we call nothing about us without us. So if we're talking about a community, if we're talking about a place, voices from that community need to be a part of the conversation. We're not going to sort of parachute in and just talk about a place as if we know it. We want you to bring your stories and your perspectives to the conversation. And then, like I said, we're interested in helping the country have a conversation that is someone in Vermont talking to someone in Michigan, talking to someone in Mississippi, because in the current media landscape, which is so fractured, it's so easy to create your own little bubble, mm-hmm. and to be very disconnected from what people across the country are experiencing. And so how do we provide a space where people can be in conversation together to talk about not just the problems, but the solutions, the things we can do long term, the things we can do right now? And those are three of the central ideas of the program. But we also really try to speak to every part of you as a human being. So we all know there's tons of politics to talk about. There's a lot of heavy news right now. But we also want to bring you moments of joy, moments of humanity, moments of connection. So it's not just the politics that we're covering. We're talking about authors and artists and musicians. We're talking about people's health. We're talking about financial wellness. We cover everything because we hope you can find a point of intersection and connection in every conversation we have, because it connects to something you experience in your life.
Yeah, it seems like there's something for everyone if they just tune in and give it, a couple of hours. Different segments, each hour is going to feel a little bit different. And, it's a show people that I hope will discover, especially now that we've got it in our 10 a.m. till noon slot. I mentioned in the Billboard Today show, Jen, that you got your start at Michigan Public Radio. Later, you were hired at WBEZ in Chicago. You took a deep dive into the podcast world there. You produced two in-depth programs about two very famous people, Oprah Winfrey and former President Barack Obama. And I want to ask what it was like speaking with those folks in a moment, but there's another podcast you produced that sounds really fascinating, also sadly relevant for our times. It was called 16 Shots. What did that show cover?
So 16 Shots was about the shooting of Laquan McDonald. He was a young black man in Chicago who was shot 16 times by police officer Jason Van Dyke. When the shooting occurred, a narrative emerged immediately from the police and the police union that it was an unavoidable shooting. Laquan McDonald was acting erratically. He had a knife, and that he was causing some property damage. There were calls and complaints about him. A lot of officers arrived on the scene. And that when Jason Van Dyke arrived on scene, he was one of the last officers to arrive. When he got out of his vehicle, Laquan McDonald made a move towards him, and he was compelled to fire his gun. There was dash cam video of the shooting that wasn't released to the public. And so this narrative of what happened was allowed to take hold, even though there were witness accounts that were turned away by police. They weren't taken or shared with the public. And it just really came from community activists and journalists really leaning on the city to release that video cam footage. And what emerged was something very different. It was a young man who was in some kind of crisis, who was moving away from police officers when he was shot.
Not lunging at them with the knife.
And Jason Van Dyke was the only officer on the scene who fired his weapon. That led to, eventually, some fallout in city politics. Also, Jason Van Dyke going on trial, and he was found guilty of, if my memory serves me correctly, second-degree murder and 16 separate counts of assault for firing his weapon each of those 16 times. But it highlighted a longstanding tension in the city between the city's residents and the police. And there was this terrible chapter in the city's history where there was a sergeant who organized a group of police officers, and they would torture people into false confessions. So there's this deeper history in Chicago, and this incident, which very easily could have just, that narrative could have stuck, that Laquan McDonald was a danger and that's why he was shot, and the story could have disappeared. So in the podcast, what we tried to do was to tell the story in its complexity and in its wholeness, to also examine why journalists just sort of picked up the narrative that was being presented by police officers without deep questioning. Mm-hmm. Like, why has that become the practice that we're told this is what happened, but we're not doing that deeper level of investigation? And then we covered the trial in the podcast, but the other part that was really important, perhaps in some ways most important, was to tell people who Laquan McDonald was.
Yeah.
Who he was as a human being had been lost in the narrative, and his family wasn't speaking to the press, so two of our reporters found the neighborhood where he spent a lot of time, and they connected with some of his friends, and we were able to create a more complete picture of who he was, what he wanted for himself, the challenges he'd faced as a young person, the instability in his life, but also the things that that were funny about him. He was a funny young man, so that he didn't just become a hashtag
or a
name or a statistic. Yeah. He was a whole person. And when any community loses a person, there's a hole left there.
Yeah. So, you know, I can hear the emotion in your voice in talking about this. It was a great piece of journalism, but also emotional. And I wonder if something like that helped you with some of the more difficult shows you do now on 1A. I mean, getting that grounding fairly early on in your career, you know, delving into such a difficult topic.
Yeah, I mean, I would say really going back to my Michigan days, my Michigan radio days, when we were covering the Flint water crisis, that experience helped me understand the importance of connecting policies, practices, laws to people's lives. You can explain a thing and say, this is the thing our government is doing. But if you don't connect it to the lived experiences of people, it doesn't really mean much. It's just words on paper. And so really going back before I even got to Chicago and seeing how a series of decisions made by the government in Michigan, by the governor, by the emergency manager in Flint, how the series of what were purely economic decisions in many ways led to a severe health crisis in the city of Flint. We're talking about lead poisoning with children.
Yeah.
Right? That experience really grounded me in the importance of connecting what's happening at the policy level and what that means for people's lives. And it is deeply emotional. And it's really challenging, I think, for not just me, but all journalists who are doing this kind of coverage, to reground yourself in a way that lets you come back to the work the next day with the same level of care, the same level of empathy, and not to become calloused, because it's easy to become calloused and quite cynical.
Cynical, yeah. That's the word I was thinking of, too. Mm-hmm. You're hearing the voice of Jen White, the host of 1A. Let's go to the phones right now. You can give us a call, by the way. I should mention 800-639-2211 to speak with Jen White if you'd like to. And Earl is on the line from East Corinth. Hi, Earl. You're on with Jen White.
Thank you. And it's just an honor to speak with you, Ms. White. I appreciate your journalism. I was wondering, you've mentioned sometimes that you're the daughter of a preacher and I believe an Episcopalian as well. And how does your faith affect the journalism that you do? And full disclosure, I am an Episcopal priest.
Thanks for calling, Earl, and thanks for that question. So I grew up in a non-denominational Christian church. My father was a minister. He's deceased now, and I miss him terribly. And I would say that I'm not a particularly religious person these days, but I maintain a spiritual practice. Part of what my parents instilled in me, both my dad and my mom, because my dad was a minister, but that meant by default, so was my mom. That's just kind of how these things work. They were so rooted in service. The way they practiced religion, it wasn't just about scripture. It wasn't just about their relationship with God. It was how their relationship with God informed the way they served people. My dad was an amazing speaker, and he hated speaking.
Really?
He hated speaking. He grew up with a speech impediment. He had a stutter when he was a kid, and so he was always nervous, even though he had this amazing, this resonant voice. We called it the voice of God. We just loved listening to him speak. But what he loved as ministry was the service. So up until the time he was unable to do so. So he had polio as a child. And so later in life, what can happen when you have polio is that it's almost as if your body experiences it again. And so he had a lot of muscle weakness, and he wasn't able to really stand or walk for long periods of time. So he was in a wheelchair. But up until the day he was physically unable to do so anymore and mentally unable, he had vascular dementia. My parents would visit people who were sick and shut in. So my dad would be in his wheelchair and my mom would push him. Sorry.
That's okay.
Would push him through the halls of a hospital to go visit someone who was sicker than he was. And that example of service, that example of care for people, is foundational for me in the work I do. And I also, the thing my parents really instilled in us was the importance of allowing yourself to be used for good. And so before I go on this show every day, I spend some time just thinking and praying and meditating. And this may sound kind of woo-woo for some folks, but really asking that I be used in a way that is of service and that is beneficial to the people who are listening, that's beneficial for our team, that's beneficial for our station and the world. And it's that's the way I approach the work. And it can be a very vulnerable space.
Sure.
And a very vulnerable way to approach this work, especially when you feel like, I don't feel like we got there today. But you come back the next day and you do it again, always through that lens of what am I here for and how am I serving you? So those examples from my dad and from my mom and the way they practice their faith, it feeds into everything I do.
Jen, I really appreciate you sharing that story about your father who passed fairly recently, I guess, and some of the difficulties he had with health, with a stutter, as you were mentioning. It seems like he probably didn't get to hear Joe Biden, the president, talking a lot about his own stutter and some of the issues he's had with that. But was that something that your father was aware of, you know, having his own difficulties, but that there were always other people, you know, who also had sometimes deeper difficulties and that he felt a need, despite his own insecurities, to serve them in some way?
Yeah, I mean, my dad's story, both of my parents have just really remarkable stories. He was born in 1938 in Georgia. So he was born at a time when he was not, as a black man, recognized as really a full citizen of the country. He had polio as a child, and that meant he ended up with one leg that was stunted. So he had a pretty severe limp for most of his life. They broke his other leg at one point to get it to slow down because he was a very tall man. And so the limp was becoming so pronounced, they broke the other leg to get it to stop growing so that the other leg could catch up some. But because they lived in a rural area in Georgia, and they were so far away from the school, which he would have to walk to, and he couldn't, and the teacher wouldn't come pick him up on the horse and buggy cart and take him to school. He was out of school for a while. But then my grandmother learned from a friend who was in Detroit that there was a school there for kids with disabilities, and maybe you should bring Henry to Detroit. My dad's name was Henry. And my grandmother packed up the family, and they moved to Detroit so Dad could go to school. And so he went to school, went to a high school called Cass Tech, which I also attended, and he learned there to be a drafter, which at that time, the big three, the General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, they weren't hiring black people in their drafting department. You could work on the line, but my father physically couldn't do that labor. But then in 1968, the Civil Rights Act passed, and they opened up their drafting department, and he was one of the first black drafters hired at General Motors. So he had this series of hurdles that he had to overcome, and some he was able to overcome because of decisions my grandmother made, for instance, to move to Detroit, because of policies like, we need a school for kids with disabilities. We should make that something we provide in Detroit. And then the Civil Rights Act opened up a job for him that really changed the trajectory of my family's economic future in a single generation. But when you talk to my dad, and then when he started attending the church I grew up in, they offered these Toastmasters classes, which helped him overcome his stutter.
Wow.
And so, but when you would talk to my dad and my mom, Bessie, they never shared their story as being one about bootstrapping. Look what we were able to do by just pulling up. It was never about that. They were always very clear that a combination of personal decisions, policy changes, luck, and their faith, that's what allowed them to change our family's trajectory, because both of them grew up in incredibly impoverished situations. My mother was born in 1942 in Mississippi. And when she was a child, she remembers going to school. She was wearing a yellow dress, and the school was run by nuns. And she raised her hand to ask a question, and the nun slapped her, bloody my mother's nose. My mother went home, her dress was bloody, and my grandmother pulled her out of school. That was the only thing she really felt she could do. And so when they moved to Detroit about a year later, my mother had been out of school for some time, and she remembers her cousin taking her to the library to try to get her to read a book. She said, I want to kind of figure out what grade level you might be at. And my mother remembered not being able to read the book and the feeling of humiliation that she felt. And she said to herself, as a child, my children will know to read. They will know how to read. And so we spent our summers in libraries when I was a kid. That was what we did. And so their shared experiences, my mother's focus on education and literacy, my father's focus on like finding solutions, how do you find a way through this challenge? Their parenting has been so, gosh, to call it, to say that it has informed the way I move through life is an understatement. It has shaped me in every single way. But again, they've never talked about their shared story as being one about bootstrapping. Never.
Always aware of the help they were getting.
Yes.
From their community, from people they were close to.
Mm-hmm.
Things that had to fall into place to make it possible. You say that this informs your very job today. I can totally see that, because I know that when you engage listeners and you ask for, you know, voicemails about ideas for shows, one of the things that you often respond to is people who have had very difficult health problems.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, you know, I know you've done some shows on this. Is that something that's maybe in the back of your mind, given what you grew up with and seeing what your dad went through? And
what my dad went through in my own experience. I was last year, in January, I was off the air for several weeks because I had to have surgery. I'd had a long undiagnosed condition that I'd been trying to get treatment for, but I didn't know what it was. It was a condition called adenomyosis that is similar to endometriosis, except that the endometrial tissue embeds itself in your uterine wall. It causes a lot of issues. And when I would go to the doctor and say, I'm having these problems, they'd say, oh, well, here's some birth control. That should do it. So they were treating the symptoms without understanding the underlying causes, and there wasn't a lot of curiosity about it. And then I finally found a doctor who did one or two additional diagnostic steps and was able to give me a diagnosis. And that the treatment at that point for it was a hysterectomy. Hmm. That was the treatment for it at the point I was in the condition. And so there was a lot to sort of manage around that mentally, but there was also relief in having an answer. But I knew I was not the only person who'd had that experience of going into a doctor's office and feeling like, you're not hearing me.
Right.
You're not hearing me. You're not hearing me. So when I was going to have to go out for surgery, I said to Rupert Gardner, who's our executive producer, we've got to explain to listeners why I'm going to be gone. And it felt like a moment to be really transparent with the audience and to maybe start a different conversation on the show. And so I was very transparent and said, this is what's happening. And I think probably you've had the same experience or something similar, and we want your stories. That became the first episode in what has become In Good Health, a series on the program where we bring on experts to talk about some of the many health issues we're facing, how to navigate them, how to better have conversations with your doctor to know what questions to ask, how to navigate the health system. We've talked about the discrimination women face in the medical system. We've talked about chronic illness. We've talked about things like caffeine and the effect caffeine has on your body. There's so much mis and disinformation out there. And we're a show where people can come and get answers from people who actually do the research, who are experts, and get their questions answered. So in part, it is always having my dad's story in the back of my mind. But in some ways, it's also my story. The way my dad's experience has really informed the health coverage we do isn't talking about disability. And talking about the ways in which people with disabilities have to navigate the world in a different way. And are we, as a nation, giving that the proper attention and weight? You know, I know I get to enjoy a level of privilege because I'm able-bodied. I don't have to worry about whether there a certain space is going to be accessible for me.
Right.
My dad had to navigate that question everywhere we went. Everywhere we went.
It occurs to me, too, as you were speaking before about what 1A offers people, it's that connectivity. Everybody at some point is going to be dealing with a health issue.
Mm-hmm.
This is a commonality that binds us in a way as humans. And to branch out that conversation and say, you know, how good could it feel just to get a diagnosis, to find out, oh, this is what's causing this. I have to believe that's of great, great help to listeners.
And to also feel like you're not alone. I think when you're having medical challenges, it's an incredibly isolating experience.
Yeah.
You will feel, you can get to the point where you're like, is it in my head?
Mm-hmm.
Am I imagining this? Am I being dramatic about the symptoms I'm experiencing? But when you hear people across the country saying, the same thing happened to me, or you said this was your diagnosis. Can you talk about the symptoms again? Because they sound really similar to what I'm having. There's something empowering in that experience, just not feeling alone.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. We have Wyatt on the line from Brandon. Hi, Wyatt. You're on with Jen White.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call, Mitch.
Sure.
And I want to say quickly to say hi to Jen.
Hi, Wyatt.
This is Wyatt. Wednesday. Thank you. I was at the show at the Essex Cinemas on Vermont Housing Stories and Solutions. Let me thank you again for allowing me to share my story. Thank you very much. And to enjoy the complimentary copies of the Vermont, the Brandon Reporter. Remember I gave you those two copies?
Yes.
Enjoy those in Vermont. And thank you very much. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Wyatt. It was wonderful to meet you.
Wyatt, thank you very much for that phone call. I appreciate it. Wyatt's referring to the conversation you had about the housing crisis here in Vermont at the Essex Cinemas. As I mentioned in the introduction, one of our reporters, Carly Berlin, who covers housing and infrastructure here for Vermont Public, was part of that as well. What did you take away from that, given that housing is, we have our own particular issues with the housing crisis here in Vermont that are particular to Vermont, but this is obviously a much bigger problem now all across the country. What struck you about Vermont's particular issues with this, and did it help give you a clearer vision of how to tackle this problem perhaps in the future on 1A?
Yeah, so two things that really stood out to me. One, communities have solutions. Right? People have ways they think they can make things better. And if you give them the chance to share those ideas, it's not to say every idea will work. But people are thinking about this at the grassroots level, in their neighborhoods, in their towns, and they're seeing, depending upon what's happening around them, things that will work for them where they are. And I think having an opportunity to bring those ideas to a larger audience, it's incredibly important, because even if it might not work in that town, it could work in another one. And it's like, oh, that's an idea we haven't tried here. We should give it a shot. The other one, and this is something we're talking about as a team, is doing a show about the case for YIMBYism. People are familiar with NIMBYism, not in my backyard.
Sure, yeah.
But how do we get to a place, because the housing crisis is, it's happening across the country, where we are able to get to more of a yes in my backyard stance?
That's YIMBYism.
Yes, that's YIMBYism. How do we shift to that? What kinds of cultural changes or policy changes would it take to shift more into that posture, to help people see the possibilities in, for instance, building more dense housing or utilizing spaces in a different way? What does it take, and where are people already making those changes, and we can bring those solutions to a broader audience?
We got this email, it looks like from Jonathan from Shrewsbury, who says, there are so many stories for state and national media, radio and print, 1A and Vermont Public to report, but that are never heard or printed of because reporters are always on deadline. Mm-hmm. Potential sources won't go on the record, or people have those stories, don't know how to bring them to reporters' attention. Can you recommend ways that these various obstacles can be overcome so more stories can be told?
Oh, that's multi-layered. So one thing I've noticed in recent years especially, is that as institutions like public radio are contracting in the face of economic challenges, it means smaller newsrooms, fewer people working on what feels like a fire hose of news.
Mm-hmm.
And we need more investment in local coverage. The number of local newsrooms that don't have someone covering the state legislature or the city council meetings or the school board meetings, it's troubling. Because the things that are happening at that local level are the things that are going to affect you in your community, right? We can talk about D.C. until the cows come home, and that matters. But what's happening in that city council meeting that's going to change your neighborhood? So some of it is about figuring out a better investment model for not just public radio or public television, but local newspapers. How do we make those newsrooms more robust so there are more people, because you need people to do it, just more people covering that news. So that's one thing. In terms of interacting with whatever media you're using locally, be it your public radio station, your public TV station, or 1A, we try to have an open door of communication with you. So the number of programs we do that are pitched by our listeners, either by emailing us at 1a@wamu.org or sending us a text or sending us a voicemail through our VoxPop app. We listen to everything that comes in. We read everything that comes in and we build shows around that. I got a DM from a man on Instagram who asked whether we'd ever done a show about the mental health effects of a major medical event. He said, I had a heart attack and it changed my world. And I was like, we haven't done that. That's a great idea. And so we have a show planned around that. And if everything lines up the way it's supposed to, we'll be able to lead with his voice. So it's figuring out ways to strengthen that line of communication between your newsroom and between your community. When I was in Chicago, we launched a two-hour show there. And what became clear was that Chicago's incredibly diverse. You have all of these little neighborhoods and each one has its own personality, but we were somewhat disconnected from them. So we left the station and we went to the community. We didn't ask people to come to us to tell us what they wanted us to talk about or the stories that were important to them. We went to them and we partnered with community organizations in those neighborhoods and said, we recognize that some of these people may not even know what WBEZ is. They may not know what the show is. They may know nothing about us. But are you willing to work with your partners and your contacts and bring them to this setting in your neighborhood so that we can have a conversation? And it's not about us extracting something from you. It's about us sitting back and listening.
And were you welcomed with that approach?
Yes. Yes. And we came away from every one of those community meetings with 8 to 12 story ideas for the show.
I mean, that's got to feel so empowering for a neighborhood that hasn't had the kind of coverage, you know, because newspapers are consolidating or just shedding reporters. Now someone's listening because you reached out and went there. You took that active step.
Yeah. And so, I mean, if you're in a position in your neighborhood to host one of those conversations, perhaps, is it possible to contact Vermont Public and say, I would love to do a community listening session with you. Are you willing to come to my town or my city and we can talk about what's happening here so you can be connected to what's happening here?
That's a great idea, a great approach. It's something we're trying to do. We say, you know, stories from every corner of our state. We're a small state, but it is more diverse than you may think.
Yeah.
And there are pockets often that feel underrepresented. And, you know, we need to do our very best to reach out to them. So that's kind of inspiring to hear that. Thank you. We have Robert on the line from Burlington. Hi, Robert.
Hi. So, Jen, I don't know how long you're going to stay in town, but if you're going to be here for another few days, you really should hit the trails because they took off the ban that during mud season. They don't let us hike the trails, but it's after May 1st. You should go to Huntington, then you should go to the Camel's Hump Road, and three quarters of a mile before the end of the road is the Forest City Trailhead, and it's like drop-dead gorgeous. Oh. It's like a Yes album cover. And you should not miss it if you're in Vermont.
Are
I just
trails,
want to make sure that you understand that.
Are the trails open in the fall?
They are too. Yeah. Oh, come in the. Oh, definitely. Come in the fall then, and it's multicolored. But it's just like a Yes album, except it's green, three dimensional. Just unbelievably good.
That sounds amazing.
Anyway, the real reason I called originally, I've been listening to your show for quite a while, and I'm very happy that it displaced On Point at 10 a.m. I really did like getting it an hour late, which is what we had before. Now we're getting it on at the correct time. A while ago, and I thought it was 2022, but it might have been earlier. You guys did a show on ranked choice voting, and I thought you had Miles Parks on it. He's that, you know, who I'm talking about, I think. And it really, it turned out it was just like an advertisement for Fair Vote. You had Rob Ritchie on it, and you didn't have anybody that had an alternative perspective, and Fair Vote is not going to be honest with you about ranked choice voting. Fair Vote is just going to tell you it's the best thing since sliced bread, and they won't give you any negatives. But the thing is sometimes, and by the way, I'm for ranked choice voting.
Hey Robert, Robert, I'm so sorry. I'm going to cut you off there. I want to get, because we're up against the clock here, and I want to get Jen a chance to respond to that about that show on ranked choice voting.
Yeah, I had to do a quick Google on it, and that was back in 2021, and it looks like we did have Rob Ritchie and Jason McDaniel and Ali Swadek. And I would have to go back and listen to the show again to sort of reorient myself. But what I will say is that this is an issue that's come up over and over again when we talk about the current voting system in the U.S. And I have a feeling it's something we're going to talk about again leading up to the election, because people feel, not all, but we're hearing from people who feel disempowered in our current voting system because they just don't think they have enough choices. So note taken. This is something we can go back and listen to and say, okay, how do we perhaps structure the next conversation a little differently? But thank you for that note, and we'll definitely revisit it.
Robert, I do thank you for the call. And by the way, he's not wrong about some of our more gorgeous trails here in Vermont looking like a Yes album cover, but green. Jen, just before the break, we were talking, you mentioned a little bit about the election that's coming up. We were talking before you about the media landscape, which you described as fractured. I think that's pretty much on the nose. You could use that word to describe the state of our politics these days, our culture perhaps. There are some months to go, but looming over everything is this election in November that has a lot of people, to put it mildly, rather nervous, no matter the outcome. How are you and the 1A team looking at this presidential election and discussing ways to cover it that are not going to be just the horse race, obviously? I know you're not going to just do that.
Yeah. In the current news cycle, it's very easy to move into a completely reactive posture because every 10 to 15 seconds, there's another headline that's dropping. There's another statement that's been made, another piece of social media that you can chase down and say, oh, what is this thing? And it turns into a real hair on fire approach to covering the election. What we've decided to do instead is to be more proactive and to focus on the stakes of this election for our democracy. So we have a Monday, it's every Monday in the first hour. It's called If You Can Keep It, referring to the Republic. And it's focused not, as you said, on the horse race, but on what happens post-November. So what does a decision we make in November mean for the country longer term? And so, for instance, on Monday, we covered the Supreme Court's the Supreme Court argument on the possible immunity for a president, because the stakes of that decision isn't just about the former president, it's about every future
to follow
president.
Yeah.
And so what does it mean? And what does it mean when you have a Supreme Court where there are questions about whether certain justices should even be hearing these arguments? And then what does the timing of the hearings mean for our election in November? If a decision doesn't come down, people have questions. If a decision doesn't come down by this date, what does that mean? And if you have a law degree, it's difficult to figure out. So we bring people who are experts in constitutional law to answer the questions so you feel like you have the information you need. And I think there's, again, something very empowering about that, feeling like, okay, now I can answer these questions that I have. And it's about the election, yes, but I would say, in a more complex and layered way, because we don't want to move into this place where we are just, again, hair on fire. What's the latest tweet or social media post? It doesn't serve our audience. So we're trying to be proactive and also think about ways we'll talk about the election after November and what the country may look like then. But planning ahead, planning longer term, rather than just trying to respond to the latest thing that's happened.
I love that title, If You Can Keep It. You know, it sort of raises questions right there in the title, and it gets people thinking about things. We got this email from Laura in Paulett, who says, I love your subjects and the way you invite dialogues with guests. You are so actively engaged in conversations, yet you never intrude. You and your team are always thoroughly prepared. You don't wing it. You don't have so many guests that you spend half the show introducing them, and you reach the perfect balance of inquiry and genuine curiosity that lets your personality shine through. There's not a question there, Jen, but I have to agree with everything that Laura just said about
Thank
the
you,
program.
Laura.
And it sounds to me like if that is part of your mission, it's a success for at least this one listener.
Well, and I appreciate that, Laura, and I have to acknowledge the team that makes up 1A. It's not just me. I'm the pointy end of the spear. But our producers are amazing. They are curious. They're dedicated. They're passionate. And I've said it once while I was here that doing live radio is like walking a tightrope that someone occasionally skips over and lights on fire. producers are the net. Producers are the net. And I could not ask for a better team. They're amazing, amazing journalists. And what we do on the show isn't possible without them. It truly is not.
And I can tell you from having met them myself, you know, they are super nice.
Yeah.
And it makes me think the rest of the team must be awesome as well.
We've got a good team.
We have been talking about some pretty serious issues this hour, Jen. And I do want to remind folks that 1A also, as you said before, leaves room for joy and discovery. And it is so important. You need to have that counterbalance sometimes. I'm hoping you had some time this week to discover some nice things about Vermont. As I understand it, this is the first time you've been to the Green Mountain State. What are some highlights from your visit?
Besides the beauty of this state, when we got here, it was very foggy and mm-hmm. sort of cloudy. You couldn't see too much. And then the second day we were here, everything just cleared. And the lake and the mountains, it's just stunning. But the people are so warm. I don't know that I've encountered this degree of warmth and hospitality really any other place I've traveled. It's remarkable. We had the Essex event Tuesday night, and afterwards I was very hungry. And someone mentioned Al's Fries, and so
sure.
we went to Al's Fries. That was fun. Had some shakes and French fries and such. And the other thing the team here at Vermont Public did was take us out for Maple Creamies yesterday.
That's right. We're going to give you a pass on that one.
Maple Creamies.
You're new to the state. So.
Maple Creamies, which was delicious. We went to the, oh boy, my brain is blanking right now, but it's in an old, it was a schoolhouse at one point, a big white schoolhouse.
Village Scoop, I think.
Village Scoop. Yeah. That's where we went, Village Scoop. And it was delicious. I've had so much dairy this week, y'all. I just...
Listen, you go back to D.C. and you tell them that Creamies, not soft serve ice cream, not Freezies,
it's
Creamies
different.
With four E's, that's the way it's spelled. There's nothing like that.
It's amazing. So if for nothing else, I will come back to Vermont for the trails and for the Maple Creamies.
Well, you already answered one of my final questions. Will you come back and visit
Absolutely.
Us? And we really want to. We would love to come and see you in D.C. as well. A little birdie also tells me that you're a fan of musical theater. Is this true?
I am. I'm a theater kid.
Some of your favorites, perhaps? What do you sing in
oh
the shower?
Gosh. Little Shop of Horrors. I love, that's one of my all-time favorite.
Jen Jarecki likes that one too.
Favorite
She's
musicals.
In the
it's
other room.
So good. It's so good. Other favorites. So the first musical I saw on Broadway when I was a teenager was Phantom of the Opera.
Mm.
And that experience, it's because it's such a spectacle.
Yeah, that's one of the big overblown ones.
I saw Miss Saigon and Phantom of the Opera during that trip, my high school trip, and I was just blown away. So those just have special places in my heart. But Little Shop of Horrors, and I think if I had to choose another favorite, I love Wicked. I'm trying to think of another one that I really love. We were talking about Pippin. Pippin is a great show. But really, you put me in a theater anywhere, I'm going to find something to love in that performance. Oh, Into the Woods.
Oh, Into the Woods.
Oh, my gosh.
I've never seen that live, but the movie version I thought was quite good, actually.
Oh, live. It is amazing. Go see it. Yeah.
Now, I brought this up before. I'm going to have to put you on the spot here because I do not know if you're a sports fan or not. But, and you don't have to answer right away, as a native of Detroit, you had to be aware of what went on with the Lions this year. Did you watch the game? Did you care? It was heartbreaking the way they lost.
It was heartbreaking. And I don't follow sports very closely, but as a Detroiter, I had to follow that. And here's what I'll say. It was heartbreaking, but the grit those guys have, you know?
I mean, yeah.
And to see my city rally around them as a team, that just brought me a lot of joy. That brought me a lot of joy. And you know, there are other seasons. There's more seasons to come. They'll be back. But just watching that progression, especially over the course of my life when there were just lots of moans and groans coming from from the game and, you know, a lot of heartbreak. It brought me a lot of joy just to see the city rally that way.
Well, you know, I have no connection to Detroit, but as a sports fan, I love the underdog and I love their story. And I did so want them to make the Super Bowl. Yeah. I think they'll get there. That was a tough loss against San Francisco, but I think they'll be back. I want to thank you so much, Jen White, for sharing your insights, you know, and your personal stories today. It has been an absolute delight. Thank you so very much.
My pleasure, Mitch. And Vermont, thank you for such a lovely, lovely visit.